feel when you walk into a business and you see plastered in the front window their political views. It's becoming more and more common, and we want to know if it's appropriate. Recently, we're seeing more employers across the country actually terminate people who have some kind of statement on social media, even supporting Hamas against Israel. Some of the more recent headlines connected to this. So we wanted to get our employment attorney on the show, Gary Phelan, to respond to it. Gary, I believe you're referring to what's gone on at Yale University, correct?
That's correct, Melissa.
So let's talk about this. First of all, more of an overarching statement. Is it appropriate, do you think, for businesses to share their political views?
You know, I think it's really up to that individual business. It's, you know, certainly we encourage free speech in America, you know, as being protected. Now, there's consequences of that speech. And if a company is willing to risk that they are going to be turning off some people because of that, the best example I've always heard of, you know, is where basketball great Michael Jordan was once asked why he didn't become involved in more kind of social activities on behalf of, you know, African Americans. And he said or Democrats. And he said, Republicans buy sneakers, too. And so, you know, whether that's right or wrong, it certainly illustrates that there is a cost to expressing your views that openly, you know, a company and doing so publicly.
Well, I'm wondering, in your professional opinion, Gary, isn't there a difference between if you want to share your thoughts on your personal platforms versus having the business identify with something? Because not only could it turn off the customer, but it could turn off the people you're employing. What if they don't agree with you?
Well, it is very important to distinguish between what is personal speech and what is protected speech. And that's why a lot of employers have social media policies as to what people can and can't say. Employers really can't restrict what people say on, let's say, something like Facebook. But they can restrict what people say on, let's say, a site like LinkedIn, you know, where they're identified as related as working for this particular employer. So there are distinctions, and that's why, you know, Connecticut has a specific statute that's generally called the, you know, free speech statute in the workplace that says employers can't discipline or discharge someone for exercising rights guaranteed by the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution or the state constitution. But there's a very important caveat at part of that law says also the activity does not substantially interfere with the employee's job performance or the working relationship between the employer and the employee.
I believe connected to the Yale incident, there was an outpouring of I would say, outrage against one of the universities in Boston. It might have been BU, because they, too, were in support of Hamas. And there were actually companies, Gary, I don't know if you heard about this, but companies that were saying, let us know who those students are because we want to make sure we don't hire them. It reminded me a lot of when Facebook first came on the scene and companies were looking at people's Facebook pages to make sure they thought they were a good look for their companies. Is that legal? Can a company say, I want to know who you are if you're somebody speaking out on this because we don't want to hire you? Is that okay to do?
As far as under the federal law, there's nothing to prohibit that. And the big difference is, well, I should clarify, as far as a private employer, there's no restrictions on that. A government employer where people do have, you know, a First Amendment right against, you know, a government action, that might be a problem. What's different about Connecticut is Connecticut extends those rights that are available on the federal level to also private sector employers and employees. So that's what's different. Connecticut has been, you know, kind of at the forefront of protecting employee free speech.
Now, in response to that, on the other side of this, using that Boston situation as an example, is the school required to give up those names if private companies are demanding it?
No, I don't think, not only is the school not, doesn't have to disclose that, but I think they could, you know, be in some sort of legal jeopardy for disclosing those names. And that's why, you know, for example, Yale, in response to the professor who, you know, just one of the statements posted was after the October 7th terrorist attack, said it's been an extraordinary day. Yale released a statement that Yale is committed to freedom of expression, and the comment posted on the personal account represent her own views. So that, in some ways, is from the institutional point of view, is probably the best way to respond. You know, on the other hand, if you analogize to another situation, if we all recall 9/11. Can you imagine a coworker, you know, celebrating, you know, posting something celebrating what a great day it was and condemning, you know, the United States?
But that's, I guess,
most people.
That's where I just think that gets confusing. So we have Gary Phelan here, who is an employment attorney. And that to me gets confusing because it rides that line, I would think, Gary. No, it's not threatening. You know, you're not in a movie theater yelling fire. But you're saying that you support innocent people being slaughtered. So why would Yale allow someone, even if it was a personal platform that they wrote this on, why would they stand by somebody like that? I think there's a difference between free speech and hate speech.
Well, you know, and that's certainly a good point, and there is certainly tension, you know, between, you know, in this area. There's no clear-cut line between what is and isn't speech. So the idea is to, you know, in some ways err on the side of caution. But, you know, let's say Yale had taken action against that particular professor, is they could certainly, you know, point out the fact that you had, you know, a petition of 30,000 students and professors was saying, you know, condemning the speech. But at the same time, you know, there is a fundamental principle called the First Amendment in America that's kind of celebrated. And so you're not always able to decide, here's what I think this speech is right or wrong. Who is to decide that?
Well, I guess it's contradictory. If you stand by saying we're not going to tolerate, you know, things like online bullying at institutions or at schools, but we're going to allow somebody to openly celebrate killing innocent people, I don't see where there's a huge difference.
You know what? Personally, Melissa, I agree with you. You know, I would never represent an individual, for example, even if they may have a plausible legal claim, for celebrating a terrorist attack. That said, you know, that's what certainly the law is in Connecticut for private employers. And what I would tell an employer, if they do decide that, is you have to decide what's important. And if you believe that this is absolutely wrong, then take the action you did, but make sure to have evidence that this interfered with the employee's job performance or the relationship. And one thing that, you know, if other employees say, I'm going to quit if you continue to hire, you know, employ this person, that's an example of you got to decide. And if I were the employer, I would decide I want to keep the people who are upset with a terrorist attack than protect the individual who praises it.
So that actually leads to another great point, which is, okay, so maybe they didn't break protocol. They didn't break their contract, and they didn't break any rules per se. However, maybe it has led to a decline in kids wanting to enroll there, or maybe it has led to professors wanting to leave. And getting off of even schools, you know, what if somebody's free speech led to losing sales at a business or losing really great employees. We were talking about free speech and how it can get tricky for places of business, because we are looking at an example at Yale where a professor, there were what, Gary? I can't even remember. Was it 30,000 signatures calling for this professor to be removed because of a comment she made on social media praising what happened with the Hamas attack on Israel? How many people signed that petition?
I think it was over 30,000 as of October 13th.
Wow. So my question, Gary, is, okay, so in response to that, let's say she didn't break any rules. Okay, Yale agrees with free speech, and if it's on your own platform, fine, you didn't break any rules. But now what if they see a number of students not want to go to Yale anymore? They see a drop in students applying there and enrolling for next year. What if they see really great professors on their staff say, hey, you know what, I don't know if I want to work here anymore. I don't know if I can work with an institution where you support teachers that have hate speech. Even though it's free speech, it's celebrating the slaughtering of 1,400 people in a day. What rights does the school or do businesses have to say you're impacting sales, for example, or employees leaving this job?
Let's first talk about outside of Connecticut, because Yale's a private employer. Yale could take whatever action it chooses to take because the person's speech is not protected. In Connecticut, because of Connecticut's free speech statute, Yale would have to show that this interfered with the employee's job performance. And certainly, where some of these actions has resulted in a substantially declined enrollment, that would be an example of where it's a job-related action. You're not taking action based on the speech. You're taking action based on the impact of the speech. And that's what would distinguish it. But one of the things that's two most important words in Yale's statement is the person's personal account. Mm-hmm. So they were distinguishing. I think if that person had posted that, say, on LinkedIn, where it identified them as a professor, chances are they would have terminated them. I don't know that for sure, but certainly it would have. The person wouldn't have had the same protection. And very likely it would have violated the employer's, social media policy, which many employers have these days.
Well, and another thing, though, too, Gary, that can get really tricky is how would a school, I know this is a private institution, but like how could you even prove that maybe you're losing sales or in this case you're losing enrollment numbers because of that person? I mean, I don't even know how you could prove that. You know, if you see a drop in your enrollment numbers, let's say by 5,000 students, and you're like, wow, that's significant. How could you even prove that the reason is because they're like, you know what, Yale, you didn't reprimand this person. You didn't stand up for what happened. And for that, I don't want my kid representing your school. Yeah, how could you prove that? I don't know if you can unless all 5,000 students who maybe were going to go to Yale come out and say, hey, if you had gotten rid of this teacher, I would have gone here. Like, unless you have that in concrete writing, I don't even know how you could prove that this one professor's actions did lead to a drop in sales or enrollment in this case.
It would be very difficult unless you go back and try to, survey somehow what was the catalyst for the decline in enrollment and try to distinguish what could be other contributing factors. So using that as an example, yes, it would be hard to prove.
Well, Gary Fallon, I think you've given us a lot to think about and realizing how Connecticut's rules also work with this. Thank you so much for your input. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Melissa.
Gary Fallon, again, is our employment attorney here on The Morning Show on WACC. The general election is coming up in 2 weeks, and we want to make sure that voter turnout is higher than it has been in Connecticut. Did you know the Secretary of State told us that during presidential years, about 80% of Connecticut voters will go out and cast their votes? But during local elections, it's less than 30%. So we want to talk about one of the local races that many of us have our eyes on. Maybe you do as well. And that's the mayoral race office in the city of Milford. Joining us now is the Democratic candidate running for mayor. Carrie Rowland is here in studio. Good morning, Carrie. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Yes. Welcome to WICC. First of all, tell us a little bit about you and your connection to Milford.
So I was born and raised in Milford. I've been in the Registrar of Voters office for the last 15 years as registrar. Been the registrar for elected since 2014. And I've just been really privileged to serve at a time when elections come under a lot of scrutiny. And with my partnership with my Republican registrar, we've really gotten the job done here for Milford residents.
What is your job when you work for the registrar? What does that mean?
So it's complicated because sometimes people think we work one day a year, election day, which is not true. There's a lot of that goes into prepping. But we also register voters. We work closely with the city clerk in terms of preparing and ordering ballots and getting our memory cards ready so the tabulators actually work and count accurately. So there's a lot of coordination that goes into it. And cleaning up the voter rolls is something that the public has sort of heard misinformation about, but that's something that we do on a day-to-day basis. We call that our daily work, and that's enough to fill our day, certainly.
Wow. So what made you want to go from working with the Registrar of Voters to now running for mayor?
Well, you know, there are words on the back of the walk card that I use when I go door to door, and honesty, integrity, transparency, and fairness. They are not words that just sound good to me. They are the words that I have done my job as registrar. That is how I work, and it's certainly how I've raised my children. So it's just part of my fabric of who I am. And so I think if we bring that to City Hall, our city is better for it.
So some Milfordites had no idea that Ben Blake even left the office a few months ago. What do you feel Ben Blake did well while he was serving as mayor for more than one term? Is there anything you'd want to continue on if you were elected the next mayor?
Oh, absolutely. Ben did a lot of great things in Milford. And if you look around, you can see them throughout town. And he certainly did a good job of keeping taxes very low here. One of the things that I want to do now is start to invest in our critical infrastructure and doing some of the maintenance work, not necessarily the big projects just yet, because with our economy the way it is, we have some real fiscal difficulties that we're going to have to, challenges, let's call them challenges, that we have to face in the next couple of years. And so if we do some of our maintenance work now, I think that will benefit us. And it's not just the buildings, it's the people. I think that Mayor Smith has done a really good job of being vocal about how important it is to take care of not just police and fire, although they are very important, but people who have been working for public works and even just are like myself in city government, making sure that we're retaining people, good qualified candidates are applying for open positions, and we're taking care of the folks that do the work on a day-to-day basis for the city.
So we have Carrie Rowland here who is running for mayor in the city of Milford. When you say infrastructure, could you be a little more specific? Like, what do you mean by that?
So critical infrastructure is what elections has been called. And we fall under Homeland Security now because of the threats made to elections and election workers. And we've had conversations with FBI and people and gone to training from and heard from people from Homeland Security about that. So there's one aspect, but our buildings, our city buildings, have not been upkept or maintained in the manner in which I think a lot of people have come to expect here in Milford. And so, you know, there are little things. And do we put money into those buildings or do we talk about new buildings? And, you know, those are the kinds of things that as soon as I get into office, I'm going to look at. And what are the biggest difficulties? And I'm sure that our public works director has a list of mile long of what his priorities are. And that's what we're going to have to navigate together.
So another thing that I've noticed about Milford is it has really become a very desirable place for people to move. What can be done to continue expanding, you know, more affordable housing options for people in Milford specifically?
So that's a great question. And I'm really happy to hear that the mall revitalization is.
I was wondering what you thought.
Yeah,
about
no,
that.
I love it. I love it. Having seen the mall back when it was an open air mall with Alexander's, There was this great pizza place there that whenever my mom took us up to the mall, we got to get pizza. And so I've seen it transition several times over the years. And I just think of it more now as a community. And although I would have liked us to have invested in it sooner, because I think it would have helped us now with some of the housing needs that we have. And when we talk about affordable housing, I like to think of it as young professional housing. So those police officers and firefighters that we're having trouble retaining and filling open positions, that's the kind of housing that they need when they're starting out. Teachers, too. So to create a community and environment at the mall itself where the mall can be more successful, it certainly helps the city of Milford in terms of the tax revenue. So I really am looking forward to seeing that project get going.
How are we doing with both Milford Police and Fire? Like, are we in a good place with them, or do we still have many shortages? And if so, how do we address that?
So, you know, I've been talking not just to department heads like the chief of police and fire, but also to some of the union actual boots on the ground guys. And that's been very eye-opening for me because I thought that it was important that we added a second police officer to the budget this last budget cycle. And I was proud of that and proud that the Democrats had taken the lead on that. But what I found out in actually talking to those people that work is that we have 9 open positions in the police department right now. And that's the issue, is being able to get them through the police academy, get them trained, get them up to speed, get them working before we lose more to other towns who offer a better salary or better benefit package or even to the local universities. So it is competitive out there when you're limited in the number of officers willing to go out there and serve their community.
So we were just talking during the commercial break. I have Carrie Rowland here, who is running for mayor in the city of Milford. And voter turnout is actually higher in Milford.
Yes.
For local elections. That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yes. I'm proud of that fact, actually, because we usually see about a 40% turnout for municipal elections, which is what you said, 30% is the average statewide. And so I'm proud of that because I think what I've found just knocking on doors and talking to sort of the average citizen is that they are engaged and they are intelligent and they know how to go out and find the information, because sometimes it is hard to find local news these days. You know, we don't have the newspapers like we used to, and certainly television doesn't cover local stuff.
No, it really doesn't. So I'm happy to hear that, and that really encourages me. That I'd love to see more, you know, get to that level. I mean, even higher than that. But that's really good to know. I want to talk about schools, if you don't mind, Carrie, because
Absolutely.
I have a little one in the public school district, and I know this is probably the number one thing I hear from Milford residents is their concerns over school budgets. Is there going to be a school eliminated? How many schools does Milford have?
Now, that's a tough question, but I believe it's 8 elementary, 3 middle school, and 2 high school.
Okay.
And then we have the alternative ed high
right.
school as well.
So is there an elementary school that could potentially, I see Harborside signs everywhere that, you know, save Harborside. What's the deal with that?
Well, you know, the mayor doesn't really get, you know, this is the superintendent of schools and the board of education. So I want to stay in my lane a little bit and make sure that people know this isn't my decision. But I will say that, you know, it's a hot topic in Milford. And I, you know, having lived here my whole life and grown up here, I went to the Point Beach School, which closed when I was in 6th grade, and I had to move over to the Orchard Hill School.
Oh.
And so I have firsthand knowledge of what it feels like. And I have lots of stories and memories that some of them not so positive of what that change is like and what that disruption is like. And we've had a lot of changes in our schools trying to find the right way to do it. I would be opposed to closing Harborside on the mere fact that it would divide our city right in half. There would be 4 elementary schools that feed into 1 middle school that feeds into 1 high school, and that would be one side of town, and then the same thing on the other. And I don't like that. It brings me back. It makes me think of West Side Story, you know, where
that's interesting.
It's, you know, it's easy to not like someone or to be against another side if there's no crossover.
Mm-hmm.
And Harborside is the wonderful place that allows for that crossover of both sides of town, so that kids go to the high schools and know people from both sides of town. And I think when we do that, and I like that with our little leagues and things like that, where it's more of a whole town as opposed to what it used to be when there were so many kids playing baseball, kids on one side of town playing in this league and kids on this side playing on the other in the other league. I like that we get together and we have crossover from one side of town to the other. I think that makes us a stronger community.
So how do you save the school then? Again, kind of staying in your lane, I understand that this is more, this is not the decision of the mayor, but then how do you save it? Because it seems like it keeps coming back to funding.
It does. And that is an issue. And I think that we have to keep looking at it because I think we're in a very big transition time, just generally, economically, our development. We talked a little bit about the mall, changing some of our commercial real estate to allow for mixed use and allow for some housing, which is much needed. And I think the schools are in that transition, too. And I've attended a couple of the community conversation events that the schools have had and learned a lot about how quickly education is changing and how quickly we get information and data through our phones these days. And I think how we teach kids is important. And we need to know if class size is, you know, is that the deciding factor? And then we need to look at enrollment. If we are creating some new housing that's affordable, I know that a lot of the families that I've talked to moved here just because of the school system and the way and the direction that it's taken, a positive direction that it's taken. And I I'm hesitant to close a school because once it's closed, then you're talking about having to build a school, and that's certainly much more prohibitive mm-hmm. than maintaining them and keeping them going. And we have seen sort of a flattening of the declining enrollment. And that always is an indicator to me that we probably will see enrollment increase.
Okay. And another thing that I've noticed, just again, having a child in the district, but I didn't grow up in Milford. I am a Connecticut native, but I didn't grow up in Milford per se. It sounds like redistricting happens a lot here. Like a lot.
Well, I think because of the changing trend is so quickly about where are families starting, you know, to raise their children. Mm-hmm. I mean, so you didn't start here, but you came here. And maybe it was for work. Maybe it was because you knew the schools were good. Maybe it was both. And I think that's what we have to try to look ahead. We have to be ahead of the curve. If we're going to be an effective government, that is the key to success, is trying to stay ahead of the curve and not be so far behind. Because then you're reacting. And reacting is never, you know, as a coach, many years as a coach in youth sports and high school sports, I always tried to teach my kids to respond, not react. And that takes a little foresight and a little patience. And I think that's exactly how we have to govern now.
So we have Carrie Rowland here, who is running for mayor in the city of Milford, and we'll get you the details on her website if you want to learn more in just a minute. Carrie, what do you think about having resource officers at schools? I was surprised to see that we have roaming police, but we don't have police that are, you know, they have to be at this school throughout the day, or like it. I was kind of surprised about that.
That they moved around?
Yeah, that they moved around, and we don't have like a, you know, we don't have this officer who always responds to this or stays on campus, like that they're just constantly kind of roaming. I thought that was sort of a potential security, I think,
well,
maybe problem. I don't know.
I think that, you know, it's a tough one because funding and that cost is an issue, right? And knowing, again, the way the schools have been and you know, worked with them as elections are, the polling places are in many of the schools.
Right. There you go.
I have a little bit of the inside information about the really great job they do in school safety and security. And they if you want my opinion, they are ahead of the curve and they are aware. Now, I will say that I also got a call at home over the weekend from someone who's concerned about school safety. And I think that
it wasn't me. I promise.
No, it wasn't. But it's, you know, it's something that's in people's minds. Mm-hmm. But I really believe just through my work in elections in the schools that the school system is very much on top of their security. And if they thought that this was a problem, they wouldn't be doing it. They take that very seriously.
So, Carrie, what is your website if people want to learn more about you and they want to hear more about your campaign ahead of the general election? Where do they go?
CarrieForMayor.com. Is our website, and there's some general information there, and we're getting our mailers out now, so keep checking your mailbox, and you can follow along on Facebook. That's really where I put my day-to-day Operation It's Also Carrie for Mayor is the page. So go out there and like it. Follow along as we go through the next 2 weeks.
All right. And again, Carrie Rowland is the Democratic candidate running for mayor in the city of Milford. And Carrie, I want to thank you so much for coming in studio and helping us to get to know you a little bit better.
My pleasure. I hope we can do it again.
Yeah. Looking forward to it. Carrie Rowland again here on WICC.
Crime prevention expert, retired Fairfield Police Lieutenant Jim Perez with Crime on the Mind. Exclusively on Melissa in the Morning. WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Do you want to know why we launched Crime on the Mind 4 years ago when I took over the morning show? It's because society is scared. And there are a lot of reasons why it makes sense that people are scared to live in this world today. So the reason we created this was so you didn't have to live scared, so that you could live smarter. You could have a more active brain and you could be more prepared for what threats could be out there and actually live more peacefully. I know that seems contradictory, but follow us on this. If you're more prepared for the inevitable or for what could be lurking around the corner in your neighborhoods or wherever, you're going to feel more protected. You're going to feel more confident to go out into the world and do what you need to do without feeling so afraid of leaving your own home. And so Jim Perez is here, and we are tackling a massive topic these next few weeks on Crime on the Mind: terrorism. It's something that unfortunately has happened here in Connecticut. It's happened in our country. It has happened in our globe and continues to do so. So, Jim, start us off very slowly, because I think this is not only a very big topic, but it also can be a very depressing topic. And I don't want to be depressed on the show. I would rather just give tips, and I'd rather give insight, and I'd rather give empowerment, really, to the people listening to the show. So thank you for doing that. But let's dive into, dare I say, terrorism.
Sure. You know, it's funny because you mentioned it. It's people think that if they avoid a topic, right, any particular topic, especially when it has to do with crime or getting hurt or physically or anything like that, that it'll go away.
Right.
And the sad reality is that it's not going to go away. In fact, we might be looking right now at all the issues that are going on in the Middle East, but in reality, those issues are brewing right here at home. And when I mean right here at home, I'm not talking about, like, you know, in California or down south. I'm talking about right here. And if anybody needs a reminder, I want to take them back a little bit if I could, because this is a huge topic, and this is something that most people, it's not even in their radar. They don't even think about it as much as they probably should be. It's only law enforcement, intel agencies, and military that are constantly sort of, you know, we've been surrounded by this for so long that, you know, it's almost like second nature. Like, we don't even, it's just part of life.
It's part of your DNA. You're thinking about it constantly, and that's how you're able to live the lives that you're living.
Right. And unfortunately, when it comes to basic crimes, forget about terrorism for a second, but just basic crimes, most people aren't even aware of it. They're so scatterbrained in a way, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but I just, well, you know, I don't mean it in an insulting way, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that people, especially here, we're so comfortable because, you know, we don't have rockets on a daily basis raining down on us. We don't have threats from border towns that we have different threats. You know, we have threats of property crimes, and we have threats of, you know, road rage and simple assaults and things like that. But what we don't have is the constant barrage of looking over your shoulder. And that's when you live in that environment, you're actually becoming so street smart, and you're becoming so resistant to crime that it becomes a part of you. So every day there's certain routines that you'll start to do without even thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this show is about. And that's what this show aims to do, is to kind of change people's thoughts and habits and behaviors so that we can better be equipped as a society, especially a free society. And that's the difference. And now more than ever, with the border open and God knows who's coming over, we really have no idea at all as to
what threats
we're dealing
could be
with,
lurking.
Who we're dealing with.
Sure.
And I suspect that it's going to be infinitely worse for us in the coming near future. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but the reality is that we are so asleep at the wheel that our danger level is greater than before 9/11.
So that's a really terrifying thing to think of. So, Jim, again, getting back to the purpose of Crime on the Mind, you know, what are some things if people have been, let's say, asleep at the wheel? You know, I can't believe what's going on in the Middle East, and I'm so glad nothing like that would ever go on here. What should be some mentality changes we should be making as early as today?
Well, everyone should be more defensive in thought. And indeed, and so that, because, you know, you gotta understand something. As danger arises around us, the police level, and I'm just saying, like, you know, the strength, the resources, the finances, all those things, are only so limited. So our police departments as a whole, and our intel agencies and our military can only do and operate as much as we can handle. And I think right now, every police department is pretty much almost at the max, where we're kind of, you know, we're just towing the line. We're holding the line.
They're also overworked because we have shortages. Although I actually thought of you today. I don't know if you saw this story out of Stratford, Jim, but I thought of you when I heard it. Did you see that Stratford police were able to find the guy who made the bomb threat at Walmart? And it was because employees at the store were clever enough to go back, check the ID, and then give it to police. And it speaks to something you talk about a lot on the show, which is be an active member of society. Help police. Don't just imagine that they're superheroes. You know, help them out and say, hey, this could be something. Here's a tip. Here's something I noticed. Could this be significant in your investigation? They found the guy. They found the guy who made a bomb.
And without input from the employees, it would have been difficult. And believe me, the police get frustrated because we're in the business of solving problems and solving crimes and making people not only feel safe, but actually be safe. Mm-hmm. And the only way we can do that is, and I've said this, you know, forever, you know, that, you know, you're only as strong as the input and the involvement of the community, because they're
police,
the eyes and ears for us. They're
the
ones that help us. Police could never
department.
Do it by themselves, you know, for the most part.
Yeah. Right. So what you're saying is your police department is only as strong as your town is willing to support them.
That's right. And so when you get communities that are railing against the police and they're talking about defunding and this and that and all this other political craziness, what ends up happening is you're only hurting the very people that you say you're sticking up for, because they now have to fend for themselves and they now have to kind of figure things out for themselves, because there's going to be a delay in response. There's going to be probably no response at times. There's going to be, you know, listen, we give our police officers a tremendous amount of trust, tremendous. And I mean, like, you know, these are people that are going through your homes. These are people that will find unlocked houses and will actually secure for you. These are people that when you're on vacation, they will, you know, look out for your property. All these things are starting to disappear because of this whole anti-police climate. And unfortunately, it's coming at the worst time ever. It's coming at a time where police departments are already maxed out. Terrorism is here all over the place. Threats to our society, to our free society, is being threatened almost every single day. And of course, now we have actors in the country that we have no idea who the heck they are, where they came from, where they are. I mean, it's just, it's madness. And I fear for the, and I hate to, you know, I hate to be cynical like this, but, you know, you almost have to be, because there's no other path to take.
So, Jim,
you know,
we're heading in
for some serious problems in the coming future, unlike that this country has ever seen before. And it's going to resemble, and you heard it here because I'm talking about it right now, it's going to resemble exactly a piece of what's going on in the Middle East.
So, Jim, I want to back up and I want to define what terrorism is, though, as well, because I think sometimes we depict something as, oh, this is what it looks like. And that might be also a big reason why people are what you call asleep at the wheel. So we're talking about terrorism during our Crime on the Mind segment, and we're sort of outlining it for today so that we could dive into ways you could better protect yourself during the next few weeks as we continue with this topic. Jim, can you just back up really quick and define terrorism? Because I think sometimes we have it in our minds what it looks like because we look at the media and what goes on across the globe. But what could terrorism be that maybe we're not thinking about?
So the actual raw definition of terrorism is the unlawful use of force or violence against persons or property, really to intimidate or coerce governments or the civilian population of any segment in furtherance of political or social objectives. So in other words, terrorism has been tied, has been woven with social objectives and also with political objectives. And the bad guy knows that if they can create huge violence, just huge violence in any particular area in the country, that most citizens who are normal, you know, freedom-loving citizens that, you know, want to live freely, if they can disrupt that, they know that it will change the minds of people. And if you look today, if you look at 9/11 and when it happened, the country united really as one against radical terrorists all around the country, all around the world, rather. And we sought out to go get them. Now, fast forward to 2023, and this horrible act happens in Israel, this violent attack for no, you know, for no reason. And all of a sudden, we're not united as one today.
No, we're not. We're super divided. Yes.
We're super divided. And most of the young people who are the future of this country are being trained. And I say trained because they're not being educated. They're being trained to actually be activists and to actually be on the wrong side of history. And you see this playing out. And I'm telling you, it's scarier than you think. Because when the Holocaust took place, everyone in the world, other than these bad people,
the Nazis,
were outraged.
Right. Right.
Today we're seeing kind of almost like half and half. And in this country, the leader of the free world, this is concerning beyond anything we've talked about in crime prevention. This is really paramount. Because this is leading us to the self-destruction of our own nation.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we are well too armed in this country to have any occupying force come in and successfully try to take over. And that's largely because of all the guns that are in this country, and people will fight. So they know that. So what they do is they play long ball. They're playing long ball, and long ball, some of the results are coming in now. And the long ball is take a whole generation and change their minds and get them on our side, and the destruction of America will happen within itself. And this is exactly what is playing out. I can't believe that people can't see it. There's truly true blindness going on, and I think we need to reverse it real quickly. And I think that a lot of the large donors in the higher institution are stopping their funding, and I think it's rightly so. And I think that we need to send a message collectively, starting with the youngest generation, and telling them that it's not good, it's not cool. And I'll tell you, and unfortunately, people are benefiting from it. People supporting these institutions, they're benefiting, whether they're
right.
Working or whatever. I don't care. I'll have an argument with anybody about it because I know I'm right. You know, you cannot help support this kind of mentality, much less this way of life, because, you know, terrorism is everywhere. And every law enforcement officer knows that. Terrorism is everywhere. And we need to do everything we can to root it out. And if you can't root it out, you need to leave it.
Well, and that's why we're going to focus on this for the next few weeks for Crime on the Mind, and to better help us train our minds and to better understand really where we are at in 2023. So, Jim, I think you've set a good spot for us to know what we're going to be discussing in the next few weeks. And I look forward to learning more and to sharing that information with you out there listening for the next few weeks. And so I thank you so much for tackling this. It's not a fun topic. It's one that we'd love to pretend is not alive and well, but unfortunately it is. And so it's better to be informed. And I'm glad that you are going to take the lead on that starting next week. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
All right.
Have a great week, and we'll continue next week, and we're going to dig deep into this. It's going to be painful at times, and at other times it's going to be encouraging. But in the end, I believe that we will all be better prepared to be able to face what's coming our way. And it is coming. So whether you want to get involved or not, it's up to you. But it is coming. The train, you can't stop it. So Here we are.
Well, Jim, I look forward to learning more from you starting next week. Thank you so much for hosting Crime on the Mind. We really appreciate it.
Sure. Have a great week, of course.
You too. Jim Perez will be back Monday morning, and we will dive more into this topic. And if you have any specific questions or things you want to learn in regards to this, please, this is the time to ask. You can always email me or call us directly, 203-333-9422.